Welcome to the UCSF Sports Medicine Podcast, 6 to 8 weeks, Perspectives in Medicine. During our program, we continue to cover a variety of hot topics in the sports medicine world and more.
Welcome to this week's 6 to 8 weeks podcast. I thought we'd do something a little bit different. We talk a little bit about what goes on when you don't see Dr. Pandya and Dr. Lansdowne and myself in clinic. What goes on kind of behind the scenes before you come to the OR and before you come to clinic? Because a lot goes on, especially with the electronic medical record, before you actually see us. First, Nirav and Drew, tell us a little bit about your practice. Nirav, where do you see patients? And tell me what your weekly schedule is like.
Primarily, I practice. I'm a pediatric orthopedic surgeon. I see kids who are 18 and under for the most part. And so unlike Drew's practice, you have a tendency to see parents, their kids. You know, I have a lot of people come into clinic. I work both in Oakland and San Francisco at the children's hospitals, as well as in the adult clinic with Brian and Drew once a week. So kind of spread across the bay and see kind of general pediatric orthopedic patients, kids who have fractures, kids who have complaints from things that they may have been born with. But each pediatric orthopedic surgeon usually has a subspecialty in mind is sports medicine. So I do a lot of arthroscopic procedures in kids who are still growing and have to use some different techniques than adults because they're trying to make sure that we don't impact their growth and have to take in their unique anatomy.
In a given week, 2 days of clinic, 3 days in the OR, what's your average?
It typically ends up being definitely 2.5 days of clinic and then kind of a day and a half to 2 days a week of OR. I kind of have like a half to 1 day, which is kind of like a float day, which sometimes can be research, sometimes can be admin. And a lot of times, especially during busy times of the year, can be another surgery day. So definitely an even split. And it's kind of spread throughout all the various sites, both in the East and the West Bay.
One thing I think people may not recognize is that pediatrics probably has a really big ebb and flow, or pediatric orthopedic surgery. What and why is the busy time for you?
The busiest time is usually kind of like when the weather gets warm. You know, kids are outside, they're playing, particularly in the summer. I think that's the biggest ebb of traumatic injuries. We have kids who are doing things on vacation. They're not in school, which we assume that school is like essentially a place where kids are not doing something super physical for 8 hours a week. You know, they've got gym class, but you get them in the summer, they're out, they're running, they're jumping, they're falling off monkey bars, playing a lot of sports. So the summer is definitely busy from that standpoint. Then the fall kind of takes a little bit of a downturn. And then in the winter, we see an uptick, particularly here with injuries. Again, a lot of it's because kids are skiing in Tahoe. And also we see a lot of infections as well, too. One of the things we don't think about from a muscle and bone standpoint is a lot of times when kids are getting sick with their respiratory illnesses, viruses, bacteria, a lot of times that bacteria can go into joints. So we do have a lot of younger kids who get infections that we have to clean out, you know, infected joints, infections going in the bone. Kind of winter and summer are the two big kind of high points, and everything in between the little bit lower point, but different in California because the weather's good. So a lot of people are active, you know, a big part of the year.
All right, Drew, what is your weekly schedule since you and I largely have a very similar practice?
I typically see patients in the office 2 days a week and then usually operating 2 days a week. I'm primarily just at our orthopedic institute at Mission Bay. So we have an outpatient office here where we have patient rooms and we have x-ray, MRI, physical therapy, bracing here on site. So it makes it nice for people. So we're located here, and then surgery either here or at like the Mount Zion Hospital. Some of our cases, patients need to stay overnight. So we have to do it in a facility where we can keep them. And then everything from teenagers up to like no upper age limit on our practice, and kind of, you know, that transition where the kids have grown. We're not as concerned as of those growth plate issues, like Dr. Pandya was saying, but we're able to treat that whole age range, which is great.
Nirav, one of the things that I hear a lot, because we share a fair amount of patients, is Dr. Pandya is very fast. And he gets through many, many patients. How many patients in a clinic? How many patients do you see on a typical clinic day?
On a typical kind of full day, it can be kind of around 50 to 60 patients. A lot of that is, number one, I think a lot of it's preparing ahead of time. And I know we'll talk about that. It's, you're doing a lot of the prep work in terms of understanding what the patient's coming in for, reviewing their imaging ahead of time. So we can get right down to kind of the root of the problem. We obviously have a team of people working with us, PAs, nurses, to kind of get a lot of the information. You know, a lot of my kids, they're healthy. So with an adult population, you're dealing with a lot of medical problems. These kids are healthy. They come in for very individualized problems. So you can go through a lot of patients in a short period of time. And kids want to, they have their activities, parents need to go back to work. So a lot of the work is done not in a clinic setting. So we try to keep the actual visit itself very efficient.
And what about you, Drew? On an average day, how many patients do you see?
Yeah, somewhere usually, you know, 35, 40. I think that's a pretty good number. And some of it depends on time of year and what needs to be done. But that ends up being, you know, I think enough time to talk to people, but enough time to see a lot of people as well.
Okay. I think we all have pretty similar practices over the last decade of working together. Take me through how you prepare for a new patient, Drew. Do you prepare night before, the morning of, you know, you've got a new patient that has shoulder arthritis? What are you thinking of when you look at that patient's chart the night before?
Yeah, so I'll usually take a look at my schedule sometime in the week before clinic just to see if anything stands out as it's going to need a little more attention. And then for new patients, trying to see what they're being referred in for. Some people have a very complex surgical history. They've had 10 plus operations on the shoulder and trying to piece together what's been done and then what these next steps are. A lot of patients, it's just, I'm coming in for shoulder pain and there's nothing to prepare for. Like, it's just totally their story. Nothing's been done before. And this is first evaluation. So just trying to see, like, are there any of those ones where if I look a little bit ahead of time, it's going to save me a lot of time during the day. A lot of our patients, we're getting x-rays before we see them. Like, we know that we're going to need to get imaging, and making sure that the ones we're wanting to get imaging, they're scheduled for, they don't need it, trying to, you know, avoid it just to, you know, keep the day moving. Usually it's just kind of a quick glance sometime the week before.
I think for me, I look at everybody's chart that comes in, but particularly the new patients. And I think it's often surprising how much information is available, but yet sometimes the critical information is not available. And it's a little bit idiosyncratic in what information can and can't be shared. And it really depends on which hospitals are linked and which hospitals aren't based on the electronic medical record. This is an honest question that I'm going to ask you, Drew, because you're smarter than me when it comes to imaging. Why can't we share medical record reports, but most imaging not be shared?
It just comes down to how easy it is to share like a paper document. Like, it doesn't take up any information space. And then MRI, like, there are thousands of images in that, and just the sheer space of it, like, who's going to host it? Where's it going to be hosted? And then what are the privacy concerns of another server accessing that other hospital's cloud system, essentially? I think that's why it's still such an issue. I mean, that's totally the biggest thing that would make things so much easier if we could just, you know, you had an MRI done, we have access to it, rather than like people show up and it's like, yeah, I did get an MRI 2 weeks ago, and it takes another week to try to get images into our system so we can actually see them.
I think that's one of the biggest confusing parts, is it's not on the imaging facility to send it over. And oftentimes the imaging facility will smile and nod and say, sure, we'll send it over. And yeah, it doesn't get sent over. Nirav, what about for you? How do you prep for a new patient that's coming in? Do you check the records, check imaging? How do you prepare for like a patient that you suspect might have an ACL coming in?
I think a lot of it is looking through the referral. At Children's, we do a really good job of collecting information, kind of look through the referral paperwork, which has like their history, may have the imaging reports, has a sense of kind of any other medical issues you are. So I think it's getting that, and also looking through other medical problems they may have as well too, even though they're healthy. Is there some sort of issue that may have caused them to have this injury? I'll even sometimes even start the note as well too, based on what's there, and then edit it later. So that saves time. And then if possible, sometimes if we do identify a patient that may have an ACL tear or is coming in with imaging that says that, we'll have our nurse send them information beforehand about what the procedure is, et cetera. So I think a lot of the time where I come in, they've already read the information, so that I'm not talking about, well, this is what an ACL does, this is what the surgery is going to entail. So I think a lot of just getting to know the family and the surgery, know how far away they live, maybe identify where they may do physical therapy afterwards. So it's a lot of information collecting as well too. But I agree, imaging is usually the main thing I'm trying to look at, whether it's loaded in the system or there's a report. So we're not trying to sort through like what's the story and what's injured. You always want to confirm the story with the families, but a lot of it's getting a lot of that background information.
I still remember being, it was probably 7, 8, or 9, somewhere around then, and going in for in towing, which Drew and I both suffer from. Yep. Where you're turn your foot in, and Drew and I went on
we're
a
blessed
long,
to have. Yeah.
Yeah. Blessed to have. It makes us faster runners. Yeah. And Drew and I went on a long hike this weekend, and I noticed Drew trips a lot when he hikes.
No, I don't.
You tripped multiple times. And I blame
maybe once.
We have overcome it. Drew has not. But I remember it was such a different experience, because we went into the doctor's office. You'd sit and wait for over an hour, and then the doctor examines you, and then you sit for another hour, and then you're summoned to another office to have a discussion. It's totally different now. We're expected to go in, have a very quick appointment, and then come up with a plan right there. And the reality is, as you said, Nirav, the plan is already largely established. And if we have access to the imaging, have access to previous notes, have access to the diagnosis, a lot of that can be done beforehand. And then we're kind of cementing the general history, looking at the imaging and coming up with a patient-specific plan. For a while, I was doing that with adults. And I was saying, hey, I've looked at your imaging. It looks like you probably have a rotator cuff injury because you've already seen two other people. This is a third opinion. And I was sending that patient information. But then I was getting reports back in my after-visit scores like, I can't believe you were diagnosing me before even seeing me, and my scores were going down. So I stopped doing that. But I think that was pre-COVID. And I think in the post-COVID era, it's probably a little bit more accepted that we can diagnose people. I think the other thing that's really interesting and where the EMR has been great is the ability to follow up on patients after surgery and the ability to integrate how our patients are doing with physical therapy, how they're doing with post-op checks, the ability to really kind of seamlessly follow. Do you guys follow your patients with their physical therapy in their recovery process in a more seamless fashion now?
I definitely do. Like, I think especially if they're doing physical therapy in our system, we can constantly look at kind of what their notes are. The PTs, even though we see them a lot, they'll send us messages. So I do feel like by the time someone comes, we do an ACL on them and we see them at 6 weeks and they come back at 4 months, I feel like I know what's been going on with them. So it's not like, hey, how's PT going? What have you been struggling with? So I feel that makes that visit a little bit more focused. And I think sometimes it's harder when you have patients who we operate on who are 4 or 5 hours away and they come back and we may not have been getting the faxes. We call for updates, you know, we're not getting calls returned. So I definitely think that's helped a lot too. And I think going along with that, the fact that patients can message us as well sometimes, I think does help. I know we all struggle with the volume of that, but I do think that you can get some useful pieces of information like, hey, I felt this, or hey, I'm doing this. Can I do that? It just kind of keeps the visit going, I like to say, in the background, even though we're not technically seeing the patients.
One of the other parts of our job is to take patients to the operating room and fix things. So I want to talk a little bit about how we prepare for an OR case, skipping the authorization, pre-authorization, talking to insurance companies, looking at a surgery that's coming up a week or two before. What are you doing, Drew, for, let's say, an ACL surgery that's coming up? What are you doing in terms of thinking about, let's say, a revision ACL? Somebody's already had an ACL surgery. What's going through your head in terms of preparing for that?
I think all of us, we do a pretty wide range of different surgeries. And some of them are pretty straightforward where you don't need implants or very crazy instrumentation. And then those are pretty easy to plan for. You just need like kind of the basic instruments. The OR will have everything you need ready to go. And then there are some, especially like that revision ACL or other cases like that, where you may need specialized instruments, different implants than you usually use, things like that. And that takes a lot of planning and communication to make sure that when that day comes, you have the things you need. So like a week or two before, kind of going through what the plan is. And then I think it's always good to have plan A, like everything goes perfectly. This is what I'm going to do. And then there's always, you know, plan B, C, D, and there's some point that like you can't plan for, but making sure like, okay, this is something that could come up. I should make sure that this is also available. It doesn't really look like the meniscus is torn in this area, but there's some chance I'm going to look at it and then just want to have this equipment close by in case I need it. Because if I don't, then that's going to add another 30, 40 minutes to the surgery and or may not be able to have it ready to go and may not be able to treat it the way I want to. And yeah, I mean, some of the revision surgeries too, when they've had prior surgery, you have to, you know, take out implants and that can really alter what you're able to do or what you need to effectively do it. And I think the little bit of planning ahead of time, that's how things will go smoothly. And then as soon as it's like, we'll just figure out while we're there, then never the best feeling in the moment.
What about you, Nirav?
Kind of very similar to Drew. I think typically just kind of the night, kind of the day or two before, I'll kind of go through review. We have to do a lot of documentation before for patients to know it's called a history and physical. Like you have to have that up to date. So I'll review a lot of the paperwork, the imaging. Same thing, make sure all the equipment's there. And I agree with Drew. I think the key thing is not necessarily that, you know, we know kind of what's going to happen, but it's having all those plans in place for plan B, plan C, plan D. And I think that's, you have to make sure you've got all that stuff in place. So I think a lot of it's reviewing, kind of really getting up to date on the patient. And sometimes even as surgeons, we do the same thing again and again. Sometimes we need to review the anatomy, review the steps we're doing, case that's there. So I think a lot of it just preparing, just like, it's like I'm doing a presentation. You want to be up to speed. You want to make sure you're ready to kind of quote unquote perform the next day. So it's a lot of it's review of information. vacation, getting yourself ready.
I like to tell the residents, even though my outward appearance is that I'm calm and prepared, that's because 3 weeks ago, I looked at all the cases, made sure that I had everything available. 2 weeks ago, I looked at the cases, double checked that I confirmed that I had everything available. And last week, I made sure that all my backup of my backup plans was available. And then the night before, I triple checked that every measurement that I would want to have was there. I didn't have any, there were no snafus, there was no concern. So by the time I get to the day, I'm totally relaxed. So when I see the patient the day of surgery, I have memorized exactly of everything that I wanted to do so that there is no surprises. And then over the course of many, many, many years, even though I may have done hundreds of that surgery, it just feels like routine that I have quadruple checked each surgery. And the reality is sometimes that doesn't always work. There will be surprises in the OR. And there are sometimes, many times, that cases get added on within a week or two. But if you've done that routine so many times, it doesn't feel like a surprise. And it does allow you to game change within the surgery, which makes it much better. What sort of things do you agonize about the night before, Nirav?
You know, I think if it's a difficult case where something that's a little bit outside of what you normally do, I think that's always, you know, when we do things that we consistently do, like ACLs or rotator cuffs or, you know, things like that for you guys, if it's a little bit different, I think that's that you always keeps you up at night. I also think that one of the things that I do a lot of just, you know, with peds, we take a lot of trauma calls. So a lot of times there'll be cases where you don't necessarily have that time to plan. Like it's very predictable. Like you go into knee, you know it's there. With trauma cases, a lot of families and patients don't understand that. Like I am
glad you know what's when you say you go into a knee, I know what's there. That's very comforting.
good.
Most of the time.
Yeah. Most of the time. You know, every fracture is different. You never know, like you can't plan like how the bones are gonna be broken, what the tissue is gonna look like. So I think there is a little bit more anxiety with those kind of cases because it's a lot more unpredictable. I think those are the ones that are you know, kind of keep me up a little bit more at night just because you don't have that predictability in planning. I think we all go into sports because we like that predictability in terms of the cases we're doing. But I think that keeps me up. And, you know, obviously when you've got younger patients, for me, when they're younger, they're 3, 4, 5, and 6 year olds who have kind of certain injuries, they're smaller. There's less resiliency in terms of how their tissues are, how big the joints are. So those are the ones that kind of keep me up for the really young kids.
Drew, what is something that used to keep you up the night before surgery and doesn't keep you up anymore, or a procedure that you used to worry about that doesn't keep you up anymore?
A lot of it is, or like one thing is, because sometimes there's like, we could do this procedure or that depending on how it looks. And then I think the hard thing is when you get into the operating room and it's kind of like, it looks like it's in the middle. And then it's like, okay, well, I still don't have any new information. I still have to pick. And then, you know, in the moment, how do you decide which one's right is which one's wrong? And then there are some also, like, I'm thinking like shoulder replacement where you can start to like lose bone, wear it out in different ways, or like a revision replacement, things like that, where I'm going to take this piece of metal out. And then if I get lucky, it's just going to come right out and then I'm good. This could also turn into like, I can't get it out and there's a lot of bone coming with it because it's so well fixed. And I think those are still nerve wracking ahead of time, just because if you pull that out and like a lot of bone comes with it, your next steps are really pretty limited. And it can turn from like a very, you know, if it just falls right out, good to go. This is going to be a great day. And then otherwise you're, it's kind of like a sad thing that you have to deal with. And it's challenging to figure out what to do with it. So that's the first one that comes to mind.
I agree. And I think that's often things that we can't predict looking in imaging the night before, because sometimes things that don't look well fixed to bone end up being well fixed, and we can't always predict based on implants. One of the things that patients often worry about, which I think is one of the things that we don't worry about, is the involvement of a trainee. Is a trainee helpful or hurtful in the OR? And is there evidence to support that? Drew, you're evidence-based. I think your entire life is evidence-based.
What do you eat for lunch?
Loosely, yeah. Nothing. Yeah.
What do you think?
There are studies that show, I mean, I think it's things like hip fractures and other things that having a trainee present actually improves outcomes. I think it makes sense because just having like more eyes on a problem, you have like another person involved on both sides, like as the attending surgeon, somebody's kind of like watching you. And then that person is also there, like hopefully both push to do the right thing and do it as best as possible. But when thinking about it, most places and most surgeries, like there will be an assistant of some sort, whether that's a resident, a fellow, a PA. And if it's not a teaching hospital, like it's not somebody, usually not somebody just totally flying solo, like somebody else will be there assisting for a lot of the surgeries. And then it's just, who is that person? And you have a great PA who's, you know, very accomplished and really good at what they do. You could have a fellow who's trained 6 years in orthopedic surgery, and our fellows currently, like, they'll be out practicing in 2 months, and you know, you could go see them instead of like an attending at that point, like they're, you know, on their own. But it can be a definite positive, and you know, I think it also helps just push us to be better in what we do too, which is I think another positive that probably isn't seen as often, just that like trying to model how the right way to do things.
When I've looked at the literature, there are no studies that show it is a detriment. In fact, many studies show that it improves outcomes a little bit. It's a little bit hard in an outpatient setting because our metrics are a little bit harder to show improvement, but there's no increase in readmission rates, complications. And then my cynical answer is I like to show off. And the more people around that watch me operate well, the better it is. And my really cynical answer is I can't do anything crappy if a resident is around, because if I do something at all lazy, every resident in the country will know within about 24 hours. So I have to be as good as possible right away. Last question for you guys. What do you think is going to happen in the future? What do you think is going to be the innovation that's going to change how we practice healthcare, whether in the clinic or the OR, that's really going to change in the maybe next 5 years? Nirav?
I think how we do our documentation. I know some of that stuff we're starting with already. It's, you know, how do we make what we do after hours, you know, or in the clinic? So, you know, a lot of us are trialing AI in terms of how we integrate it into our medical record, into our visit. So a lot of, I think, the inefficiencies that are there in medicine, unlike other fields where we're just spending a lot of time essentially like documenting what we do. My kids always joke, you work all day, then you have to write about what you did all day at night, which is kind of like no other field has to do that. So I think that's it. And then also, like, I think we're integrating other ways of seeing patients. I know as surgeons, we do have to technically see our patients a lot. You have to examine them, et cetera. But how do we see patients without having them having to come in, and how do we improve that access? So I think that's where a lot of the innovations are going to come in with telehealth and AI kind of helping us, you know, see more patients and see them more efficiently.
I think most of our visits are wasted. I can't think of a bigger waste than somebody who drives 50 minutes, crosses a bridge to tell me they're doing absolutely fine after a surgery. And we had a great talk from the head of the Canadian Orthopedic Society that also included what a waste to the environment that is. And I can think of all the good ways we can save the earth by telling our patients, hey, if you're doing fine, send us a message, get on a Zoom visit, show us that your range of motion is fine. And also, I think the overall use of resources, we have a dwindling set of resources when you think about physical therapists, how hard it is to get to see them. We really could be efficient about using the entire landscape of resources by saying who actually needs to see what, and then utilize them. If you're a disadvantaged patient that needs to get into PT, get them in to see PT, not have one patient with all the resources also get 54 visits of physical therapy. Drew, when are we getting robots in the OR? Soon?
Yeah, hopefully soon.
Never mind. When are you using a robot in the OR?
Hopefully soon. But I think a really exciting area. And when you think about how can we make what we do better, having something that's like more precise, something that's totally reproducible. So no matter who you go see, like it's not like person dependent, like it's hitting the same target every time. And then I think, you know, there's a potential to do more that we're not necessarily able to do manually. I think there's like AI and robotics, like it's such an exciting area because I think what we do currently is pretty good, but it does seem like there's potential to do it even better at a larger scale.
All right. Well, thank you guys for giving us a little peek behind the curtain and behind what you do for about 15 hours a week at night away from your families. Next week, hopefully we'll go back to talking about injuries on the next 6 to 8 weeks podcast. If you're interested in this or other topics, join us at 6to8weekspodcast.com. And you can visit us at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you hear your other podcasts. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the UCSF Sports Medicine Podcast, 6 to 8 weeks, perspectives in medicine. What do you think of this topic? Connect with us now. In addition to finding our contact form, you'll also find our social media links in our entire 6 to 8 weeks episode archive. Help us grow our listenership by liking, subscribing, and sharing everywhere. We're eager to hear from you, and we'll be sending you more great thought-provoking content in less than 6 to 8 weeks.